KRWG News This Week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. We begin with the region's most comprehensive coverage of the pandemic. Cases are surging once again. And this week, New Mexico health officials said it's going to get worse. Here's Madison Staten.
New Mexico's COVID-19 daily case count is expected to rise significantly over the next few weeks. Acting New Mexico Department of Health Secretary Dr. David Scrace says current modeling suggests around 1,000 COVID-19 cases will be reported daily by the end of the month, noting the strain on hospital capacity.
We're going to really ramp up monoclonal antibody treatment. Our hospitals don't have the capacity for the number of hospitalizations we'll see at 1,000 cases a day, particularly if those hospitalization rates are higher with Delta.
COVID-19 daily case counts in the state have been under 1,000 since mid-January, though New Mexico state epidemiologist Christine Ross says the case count is now rising quickly.
We've seen this rapid rise in case counts, and this week they're nearly 10 times higher than they were in the first week in July. And so, again, it's the rapid rise also that has caught us by surprise and is quite alarming. And we're seeing this across the United States.
Ross says the test positivity rate has also increased significantly, rising over 6% between July 8th and August 9th.
Statewide, the test positivity rate was 2.5% on July 8th, and by the 9th, it had increased to 8.7%. And so we monitor, we try to keep an eye on the number of people that are testing and the number who test positive, because it alerts us that there's a growing number of people that are getting infected with this virus. It also gives us some indication that not enough people are testing, and so we're really putting a sharp eye on what is the access to testing and ensure that access is there.
The New Mexico Department of Health continues to emphasize the importance of getting vaccinated, seeking out testing, and wearing masks. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
While conditions are worsening in New Mexico, it's certainly not as bad as things are in Texas. Coronavirus continues to surge in Texas and Florida, with those two states representing about one-third of all new cases at the end of July. A new study indicates hospitalizations could set records in Texas as early as next month, surpassing the peak set in January, according to the COVID-19 Modeling Consortium at the University of Texas at Austin. The ongoing research involves mobile phone location data to project how much the virus will continue spreading. Associate Director Spencer Fox says if trends continue, COVID hospitalizations could surge to over 15,000 by next month. This week, they were already exceeding 10,000.
The real issue is that people have been getting vaccinated, but still not quite enough. Texas is lagging the rest of the country in terms of vaccinations, and there's pockets of the state that really only have 30% of the population vaccinated.
Fox spoke to the Texas Standard. Meantime, Texas hospital leaders warn state lawmakers they are facing catastrophe as the highly contagious Delta variant fuels that surge in COVID-19 patients. Dr. Joseph Chang is the chief medical officer for Parkland Health and Hospital System in Dallas. He told state senators this week he is facing a major staffing shortage.
And I had to make the decision 2 weeks ago to transfer pregnant patients to other hospitals because of staffing, not because I didn't have beds, but because I did not have staffing.
Dr. Esmael Porsa is the CEO of Harris Health System in Houston. He says he's also facing a staffing shortage, and those who remain are exhausted.
I am faced with a workforce who is tired, overworked, and constantly under siege.
Governor Greg Abbott says Texas will work with staffing agencies to find out-of-state medical personnel for hospitals. Both Chang and Porsa say 98% of their COVID-19 patients are not vaccinated, something we're hearing from New Mexico hospitals as well. Texas Democrats, as well as some teachers, are calling on Governor Greg Abbott to rescind his ban on mask mandates as COVID-19 cases continue to rise. Teachers are applauding school districts who have defied Abbott's executive order and put their own mask requirements in place, like Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, and Fort Worth. Caroline Sweet, an Austin teacher and parent, wants more school districts to follow suit.
Look, we understand that the financial consequences of implementing a mask mandate might be severe, even absurd. But I ask that across Texas, that we come together as a community of teachers, of students, of families, health professionals, advocates, and continue to push for the health and safety of all of our kids.
While Texas has a ban on mask mandates, it's just the opposite situation in New Mexico. Here, masks are required in schools. In fact, when the rural Floyd, New Mexico school board defied that order, they were removed from office. A Texas congresswoman is raising concerns about the state's new guidance on tracking coronavirus cases in schools. The Texas Education Agency last week said districts will not be required to conduct contact tracing. Houston Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee says that policy is shocking.
You're not going to tell me if a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old is COVID positive, that it is not the obligation of the school to let the parents of that class or that gym or wherever that child was, an innocent child who cannot be vaccinated, to let the other students know.
Jackson Lee made those comments after touring Lyndon B. Johnson Hospital in Houston to highlight staffing shortages during the latest COVID-19 surge. As we told you, an estimate from UT Austin says if trends continue, some 15,000 people could be hospitalized in Texas as early as next month. That would be a new record. Already this week, more than 10,000 people admitted into Texas hospitals being treated for COVID-19. As cases increase, doctors say more pregnant women are being hospitalized. Some have had to be put on ventilators so they can breathe. Others are on life support. Doctors who specialize in maternal and fetal care are urging pregnant women who have not yet been vaccinated against COVID-19 to do so immediately. Dr. Jessica Ehrig is with Baylor Scott & White in Temple, Texas. She specializes in maternal and fetal medicine, and she talked with David Brown of the Texas Standard.
First of all, tell us about what you're seeing when it comes to the severity of COVID-19 cases in pregnant women in the part of Central Texas that you serve.
So what we're seeing with Delta has completely changed the game from us from a pregnancy perspective. Prior to seeing the surge with Delta, we were having pregnant women get COVID, but majority of the time they were being asymptomatic. We would occasionally have a woman need to be hospitalized. Now with the COVID variant and with the surge that we're seeing, they're more likely to be hospitalized. They're more likely to end up in the ICU. They're more likely to need to be intubated, more likely to need life support measures like ECMO, and unfortunately increased risk of maternal death as well. We're taking care of more ICU critical pregnant patients right now than we have ever before in the pandemic. And that what is having us sound the alarm of concern.
Are you seeing a certain degree of vaccine hesitancy among pregnant women? Some pregnant women not wanting to get the vaccine because they're concerned about what the implications might be for their unborn kids?
That's exactly what we're seeing. Unfortunately, our pregnant population has some of the lowest vaccine rates of any population. And that's exactly why we're seeing it, is because they're scared. They're scared of, will the vaccine affect their pregnancy? Will it affect their unborn child?
Well, what do you tell them to try to reassure them? How do you handle those concerns?
So initially what I start out with is just exactly what we talked about. What's your risk of getting COVID in right now? And it's high in our community. Number two, what happens if you get COVID? And like we talked about, increased risk for mom, but there's risk for baby too if mom gets COVID, which is increased risk of preterm birth, increased risk of growth restriction in babies, and increased risk of stillbirth. And then I go into, but we can prevent some of this with the vaccine. And right now we have more vaccine safety than we had 7 months ago. We've had over 140,000 women get the vaccine. We saw no increased risk in these women of side effects from the vaccine, no increased risk of adverse pregnancy outcomes, which includes no increased risk of stillbirth, preterm birth, or growth restriction in these pregnancies. We also know that moms, when they get vaccinated, make antibodies, and those antibodies protect mom. But we've also found those same antibodies to cross through the placenta and confer protection to babies. Mm-hmm. These same antibodies are also found in breast milk for moms after they deliver, and so continue to protect baby after delivery.
These are all positive effects of the vaccine. Does the research show anything about negative or side effects of the COVID-19 vaccine on fetuses or breastfeeding?
No. No, we looked at it. We followed, a study came out that looked at 35,000 women and followed them from the time they got their first shot all the way through delivery, and are continuing to follow these babies. And we saw no increased risk of side effects following the shot, no increased risk of adverse pregnancy outcomes, and no increased risk to these babies as they've continued to follow them.
Well, clearly we have listeners statewide and a lot of pregnant women, a lot of concerned families. What do you tell them if they're hesitant about getting the COVID-19 vaccine right now?
So I say we are in the middle of a crisis with our COVID numbers. Pregnant moms that get COVID are at increased risk. And the best way for you to protect your baby and yourself is for you to get vaccinated. But not only just you to get vaccinated, for your family members to get vaccinated. And then on top of that, to wear masks and to social distance when possible.
Such important information. Dr. Jessica Ehrig is with Baylor Scott and White in Temple, Texas. The vaccination rate for pregnant women across the country, according to the CDC, is very low, about 1 in 4 pregnant women. And the CDC is urgently advising all pregnant women to become vaccinated immediately. President Biden has ordered workers at most federal agencies to either get COVID-19 vaccines or submit to weekly testing. But one agency has gone further. The Department of Veterans Affairs says its frontline health workers must get vaccinated by mid-September or they will lose their jobs. Enforcing the mandate and reaching hesitant employees is proving to be a challenge. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frain explains.
Every person who walks through the doors of San Antonio's Audie Murphy VA Medical Center gets screened for COVID-19.
Hello, welcome back.
It's part of a systematic approach to prevention that VA has honed since the start of the pandemic. But now VA leaders have a new tool to prevent infections, a vaccine mandate for more than 100,000 of the agency's health workers. VA Secretary Dennis McDonough blamed the Delta variant, which has shown itself to be highly transmissible and may lead to more severe infections.
Given that our veterans have more complicated healthcare situations, I think that it's my responsibility to do everything within my power to ensure that when they come into a VA facility, they can have confidence that they will be safe and not be exposed.
The mandate affects doctors, dentists, nurses, physician assistants, and certain specialists. At Audie Murphy, there are about 1,300 of them. Valerie Rodriguez Yu is the nurse executive. She says the mandate makes her feel validated.
I don't know that it makes me feel safer, but what I will say is that I feel supported by the Veterans Health Administration as a whole in taking this step forward to say this is, getting a vaccine is that important to us as an enterprise.
Rodriguez Yu has been on the front lines of several COVID-19 surges. She says healthcare workers have witnessed the worst outcomes of the virus and faced extreme emotional and physical hardship. So she struggles to wrap her mind around why some refuse to get the shot.
it is frustrating to know that there are healthcare workers in this organization who have chosen to not get vaccinated, because that's the only way that we can really protect our staff and protect our veterans.
Audie Murphy leaders have ordered staff members to report their vaccine status. They can also request a religious or medical exemption. Medical Center Director Chris Sandals says he's gotten a few messages from skeptics on staff, including an anonymous comment on his in-house blog.
The employee made, you know, some comments about the vaccines either not being effective or, you know, this being something Big Pharma was trying to push on the community. Not something I would expect to hear from someone that worked in the healthcare field, where we're expected to speak truth, use data and science.
Sandals says he doesn't yet know how many of his healthcare workers are unvaccinated, but he thinks it's a relatively small number. He says he'll continue to do what he's always done, provide employees the latest CDC guidance, give them vaccine safety information, and make sure they know how to get shots.
It's difficult for us to encourage those that we care for to get vaccinated if we ourselves aren't willing to do it.
Healthcare worker unions have been fairly quiet about the mandate. National Nurses United says it supports mandatory vaccines as part of a bigger public health program. The American Federation of Government Employees, which represents the largest share of VA workers, encourages vaccination, but suggests it should not be a condition of employment. Air Force veteran Charles Moore, who was outside the San Antonio VA after a doctor's visit, says he's vaccinated, but doesn't think it should be required of VA's healthcare staff. He worries that requiring vaccines will force healthcare workers to quit and bog down the system.
I hope that the VA make the right decision about this matter, because they do have some great employees, and like I would hate to lose any of them.
Frontline VA healthcare workers have until mid-September to comply with the mandate. If they have a qualifying exemption, they may be moved to areas of the medical center that aren't high risk. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Well, some are speaking out against Republicans who are trying to prevent COVID-19 safety precautions from taking effect, including commentator Peter Goodman.
Congresswoman Yvette Harrell is providing a tragic example of putting politics ahead of her constituents' welfare. There's a Delta-powered resurgence of COVID-19, particularly where vaccination rates lag. The Delta variant is more contagious and may also cause more serious infections. But Harrell and Marjorie Taylor Greene have introduced a bill that would deny federal funding to schools or universities that require people to get the COVID-19 vaccine. This could deny hundreds of millions of dollars to UNM and NMSU, which have quite sensibly imposed such rules. When I called Harrell's office to ask why, the young man who answered said, because it's not right to force school children into such preventive measures when science says the students are not in much danger from COVID-19. Actually, they may be with the Delta variant, but I asked him why would it also apply to NMSU and UNM? Their students aren't school children. He said, quote, "We're already getting out of the pandemic successfully," unquote. That was news to me. In Florida, where the governor is forbidding towns and companies to require masks or vaccines, the COVID-19 daily infection rate is higher than ever. Nationally, the death rate in less vaccinated counties is 6 times the death rate in counties with higher percentages of vaccinated people. The unvaccinated county's death rate recently jumped from about 0.8 to 2.0 per million residents in about 3 weeks. Meanwhile, Joe Biden announced house-to-house visits to give citizens information about vaccines' safety, efficacy, and availability. Harrell wrote him complaining that this would coerce individuals to get vaccinated. Actually, public health officials and sheriffs did coerce people in 1918, saving many lives. Harrell asked Biden to identify, quote, the constitutional and statutory authority, unquote, for the door-to-door effort. Our Constitution cites promoting the general welfare as a major purpose of forming the Union. When I asked her office to explain the assertion that we're getting out of the pandemic successfully, I was told that herd immunity is happening, although I've read that we're not reaching herd immunity yet because vaccination rates of 50 to 70% aren't high enough. The vaccination rate is 65.1% in New Mexico, but 50% or less in several counties in CD2. A leader might promote the general welfare through vaccination, but Harold doesn't because it's a personal choice. It is, but making that personal choice can endanger others.
Peter Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. Stay with KRWG News for the very latest on the pandemic. At the region's homepage, New Mexico residents will find two very important links. One, to register for the vaccine, and another, to get a free at-home COVID-19 test. Both of those links right now at krwg.org. Well, this week, the Las Cruces City Council extended the mayor's emergency proclamation, and they also reviewed a plan to boost economic development. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
A unanimous vote by the Las Cruces City Council has extended Mayor Ken Miyagashima's emergency proclamation as part of an ongoing city effort to address the COVID-19 pandemic. The extended proclamation will now run concurrently with Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham's executive order, declaring a statewide public health emergency. The council also reaffirmed support for a resolution requirement, stipulating the non-vaccinated must wear masks within city council chambers. While some members of the public voiced opposition, Mayor Miyagashima stressed the importance of creating a safe atmosphere at City Hall, noting that members of the public can choose to watch council proceedings online.
You come here voluntarily. Nowhere does our proclamation require you to take the vaccine. That's strictly your choice. And I just wanted to clarify that.
Council also reviewed how American Rescue Plan Act dollars will be used to boost community and economic development. Of the more than $24.7 million to be distributed to the city of Las Cruces, over $10 million will be available to help eligible 501c organizations address priorities like housing insecurity and small business revenue decline. City Housing and Neighborhood Services Manager Natalie Green says the city is asking for a clear justification of need from organizations applying for funding.
Under the project justification, we're asking for very clear objective targets, clear rationale on how it responds to the pandemic and the other available uses of ARPA.
Green says the Las Cruces City Council will need to set a funding request range for 501c organizations.
Staff is proposing around $250 as a minimum and $2 million as a maximum, and the reason for that is really just staff capacity. So when you're talking about $10 million at $250,000 each, that's 40 contracts versus 5 contracts for the $2
million. A staff review committee will evaluate each of the organizations that apply for funding, taking their proposed budget, community impact, and project feasibility into consideration. According to the current timeline, the City Council is expected to vote on funding recommendations in November. Councilor Cassandra Gondra is worried that timeline could be rushed, asking for the review process to be extended into 2022.
I think it's too fast, and I'd like to see it go into next year. We're still not out of COVID. I think so many of them are transitioning. There's issues with recruiting and retaining their employees. I guess my motto is go big or go home. I think we have to be very specific, and I'd like to see more data in terms of the areas that I think we need to focus on.
Councilor Ioana Bencomo says she feels the level of urgency is extreme, emphasizing the need to allocate money quickly.
To me, there feels like there's urgency in getting this economic relief money out, given that we're in an emergency. Like, there's qualitative and quantitative data that is telling us the gaps in our community and the gaps that were made even larger by the pandemic.
Mayor Miyagashima also indicated his support for the timeline, saying he wants the current city council to vote on this initiative, as both Councilor Gil Sorg and Councilor Gabe Vasquez have chosen not to run for re-election in the fall. While Miyagashima is excited to work with the new councilors, he says the current city council has the best understanding of how to distribute funding.
They won't have that connection that you all have had these last 16, 17 months, especially during the COVID era. I think at the very minimum, regardless of where we move, that the council vote needs to come before these two gentlemen leave office.
This initiative is expected to be further reviewed at an upcoming council meeting in September. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
The New Mexico Court of Appeals recently ruled in favor of a lower court ruling that Ultra Health could open two new medical marijuana dispensaries. Anthony Moreno talked with attorney Justin Brandt, who's a partner in an Arizona-based law firm that specializes in cannabis issues, to learn more about this case.
Justin, thanks for joining us. The New Mexico Court of Appeals recently upheld a 2018 court ruling that allowed Ultra Health, the state's largest medical marijuana operator, to open two new dispensaries in Española and Los Lunas. Now, the New Mexico Department of Health at the time didn't approve the two dispensaries, citing that Ultra Health had the potential inability to stock the locations, and the department said at the time that there was a potential inability to sustain the locations to serve patients. Can you share with us why you think that this case is so significant to the cannabis industry?
Yeah, I think it's most significant aspect of the case is that basically the courts are holding the department and the regulators who administer the medical program and now the adult use program. They're holding them accountable, and they're holding them to, you know, what the statute provides and what sort of legal authority the department has as it administers rules and regulations under both programs. So it's pretty significant in that respect. You know, the reasons why the department initially denied these applications, you're correct, definitely stemmed from their ability to stock, or at least in the department's eyes, their ability to stock medical cannabis and to supply the actual dispensaries. They also cited some other reasons having to do with security and patient confidentiality, but really what they were hanging their hat on was the ability to stock the dispensary, the product for patients.
Cannabis providers and retailers have kind of signaled the alarm that there could be a shortage in the industry once retail operations for adult use cannabis begin by next April. Do you see this being an issue with for any similar cases?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a real concern. Any time that you limit plants or limit the production capabilities of a licensed operator, you're going to run into those issues, particularly in a new market that has just become legalized from an adult use perspective. You know, there's a lot of guessing, a lot of estimating that goes into this. Fortunately, there's a lot of data out there that New Mexico can look at from other states that were originally medical programs that went into adult use programs. But certainly it's a realistic concern with any new market that comes live. You know, the cultivation cycle is right around 4 months from harvest, seed to sale. And so a lot of the concerns that are going on right now is how do we kind of on two separate paths make sure everything is being done properly from a licensing application stage, and then to when these operators can realistically get plants in the ground. The deadline to for sales is April 1st, 2022. And so we're kind of looking at this holistically, saying, okay, if we can get licenses out and approved by this date, and how much time will they have for plants in the ground before they harvest, before that product is available to the end user, customer, or patient. So there's a lot of juggling that's going on right now, trying to figure all of this out. And certainly the plant limitations have been a highly contested topic, both in the medical program, but currently as the department is working through their own rulemaking process and trying to figure out what these limits should be.
Now, what are some things that we don't know with this new adult use cannabis law in New Mexico that you think needs to be addressed to avoid any further litigation in the courts?
Yeah, so it's a good question. And you hit the nail on the head as far as another layer of challenges that a lot of, you know, applicants might not have all their ducks in a row on. And that's at the local level. So the statute, you know, gives broad authority to the department regulating, implementing this program. But local jurisdictions also have the ability to regulate it. They can't outright prohibit it, but, you know, they can enact certain zoning restrictions of where these facilities could be located, where they can't be located. They can have additional setback requirements from things like schools, other licensed operators, and those kinds of things. So applicants not only need to make sure that they're getting everything together and having all their ducks in a row at the state level with the department, but they also really need to make sure that they're involved at the local level and that their facilities would, in fact, comply with local zoning requirements and regulations. And so not only do you have the department trying to finalize their rulemaking by September 1st, but you also have local municipalities, counties, and cities that are kind of scrambling, if they haven't already, to get their own ordinances and regulations in place for these types of businesses.
Justin Brand is a partner and shareholder of Bianchi & Brand, a cannabis-specific law firm based in Arizona. Justin, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Another important health note for you. Tomorrow is the deadline. Americans who miss the August 15th special enrollment deadline to get health coverage through the Affordable Care Act will need to wait until November 1st for another chance to apply. Roz Brown has more from the Texas News Service.
Lisa Rodriguez with AARP Texas says 20% of the state's population, or 5 million people, live without health insurance, typically due to affordability or accessibility.
So if you looked before and it was too expensive, it may be affordable this go-round, again, because of subsidies that were made available by the American Rescue Plan.
Through mid-July, more than 2 million Americans had signed up for insurance through the ACA during the one-off enrollment period, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. The special six-month window was created to help people who lost health insurance due to a job loss in the pandemic. More information is online at healthcare.gov. Rodriguez says it's an especially good time for older adults who are pre-Medicare, ages 50 to 64, to learn more about what's available through the ACA. In Texas, that includes many groups affected by racial and ethnic coverage disparities.
So these folks, maybe they're in a job transition or they just don't have insurance for whatever reason. We see that when you look at different groups, like Hispanic Latinos, Asian Americans, and Black adults, they have a high percentage in comparison to their white peers of not having insurance.
New subsidy rules are expected to decrease monthly premiums by an average of $50 a month and $85 per policy per month, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Rodriguez says some people may end up paying no insurance premium, while others could save up to thousands of dollars a year. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
To Texas politics now, and it has been nearly 2 months since Texas Governor Greg Abbott vetoed the legislature's budget, a move to punish Democratic lawmakers who walked out and blocked a vote on his priority election bill. The veto has hung over Texas's special legislative sessions all summer and was upheld by the state Supreme Court this week. The governor and other state leaders recently came up with a temporary fix. But as Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports, that does not solve what some lawmakers are calling a constitutional crisis.
It's not entirely clear where the interim money for the legislature is coming from, or under what authority Governor Abbott and other state leaders are moving the funds. The end result, though, the legislature will continue to function until October 1st. That heads off a doomsday moment for more than 2,100 full-time government employees, a scenario outlined in a memo by Republican House Administration Committee Chairman Will Metcalf of Conroe. Metcalf declined to comment for this story, as did the governor's office. So to explain, I tapped Jim Henson, director of UT Austin's Texas Politics Project.
There's no funds for everything from staff salaries and staff insurance benefits down to things like IT subscriptions and the services in the Capitol. And so it effectively shuts down the legislature as a functioning entity.
Many of those staffers write the bills on which Abbott is counting on lawmakers to vote in special session. Then there's the matter of constituent services. State Representative Gene Wu of Houston is one of the Democratic members currently breaking quorum. He just returned to Texas from Washington, D.C.
Most of what we do on a daily basis in our offices is take care of our constituents, solve people's problems, help people who have been evicted, help people who need help getting care, help them with their state issues day in and day out. That's going to be gone because those offices now are going to be required to shut.
Wu says a longer-term concern, if the legislative funding is not restored soon, is that state credit rating agencies could downgrade the state's bond rating.
This would end up meaning hundreds of millions of dollars of increased costs for not only the state, but for counties and for cities, because you're now a government within a government that is unstable.
All of this assumes that the Democrats maintain their walkout, denying Republicans a quorum to vote on anything in the House, including funding for the legislature itself. There is, however, a real possibility that enough Democrats will return to allow the House to conduct business. Several already have. If and when that happens, expect both chambers to quickly vote to restore legislative funding. But perhaps the biggest lasting implication of Abbott's ledge funding veto is a disruption of the separation of powers between the three branches of state government.
This is really kind of something akin to a nuclear option in terms of the relationship between the branches.
Again, Jim Henson of the Texas Politics Project.
This fits into the rubric of Governor Abbott's sustained efforts to strengthen the executive branch within the Texas political system. And second, the degree to which the resistance from the legislature has been pretty feeble.
That isn't to say there's been no pushback. Republican State Senator Kel Seliger of Amarillo, for one, is furious over Abbott's action.
It is absolutely destructive of the separation of powers between the three branches. And it was a horrible idea to begin with. It's horrible now. Nobody knew how horrible it was. But now we do.
Seliger's authored a bill to eliminate the governor's line item veto power. But it's not on the special session agenda, so it isn't eligible for consideration this summer. But he's convinced that in the wake of Abbott's action, the legislature must pass it at some point in the future. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Immigration hearings were paused for more than a year due to the pandemic. And listen to this. Judges are facing an immigration court backlog that has ballooned to a whopping 1.3 million cases across the nation. Some people have been waiting a decade or longer for their day in court. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval has the story.
Okay, so coming back with me.
At a Southwest Houston law firm, attorney Elizabeth Mendoza introduces me to the Mendez family.
Bien, gracias.
Claudia and Francisco Mendez have been seeing Mendoza for nearly 10 years about their immigration case. They came to attorney Mendoza because of their daughter Emily.
Tiene que tener un tratamiento y cuidados especiales.
Mendez explains his daughter was born with spina bifida. Emily requires special treatment and constant care. Now 12 years old, she uses a wheelchair. She's a U.S. citizen, unlike her parents who immigrated from Mexico.
Vimos la necesidad de establecer legalmente nuestro estatus.
Mendez says when they first came to the U.S., their visa expired, but they stayed anyway. After their daughter was born, they realized they had to fix it. They couldn't risk deportation knowing their daughter would be helpless without them. They came to Elizabeth Mendoza to make it right. A decade later, they're still waiting. I asked Claudia Mendez, the mother, how she feels.
Muy estresante. Mucho estrés.
She says it's stressful waiting all this time, not knowing if she'll be separated from her daughter. Houston courts are some of the most backlogged in the country, with 80,000 cases pending and an average wait time of more than 3 years, according to court data obtained by Syracuse University.
Well, I mean, what is the saying? Justice delayed is justice denied.
Attorney Elizabeth Mendoza says the backlog affects many of her clients.
You have some cases for people who are bad actors, and their case needs to be resolved so that they can be removed from the community so they're no longer posing a threat or a risk.
On the other hand, she says there are cases where there's a strong legal reason to allow the person to stay in the country legally, like with the Mendez family.
Our immigration laws passed by Congress, by the American people, afford these people an opportunity to have their day in court.
Immigration courts are making some changes to help move through cases faster. For example, most immigration courts in Houston are reopening for hearings with two new courts and more than double the number of judges from early 2020. But immigration judge Dana Lee Marks, speaking as member of the Immigration Judges Union, says courts urgently need more funding, better technology, and autonomy.
It has to be now, because we've seen that just how badly the system can break down.
Mark says immigration courts are subject to the discretion of the executive branch. During the Trump administration, the court backlog nearly tripled, in part because of decisions that limited immigration judges' discretion. Mark says she's hopeful that legislation now being drafted to create an independent court system will bring the structural change needed to deal with the backlog and other problems. In the meantime, the Mendez family will continue to wait.
Nosotros somos uno de miles o millones de familias que están en la misma situación. Y eso impacta emocionalmente y la vida social y cultural de todas estas familias.
Francisco Mendez says he's one of thousands feeling the same emotional impact, waiting anxiously for their day to be heard in court. They have a hearing scheduled for January. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
In focus this week, student athletes are now allowed to earn money from the use of their name and image. We'll hear what New Mexico State University Athletic Director Mario Moshe and UNM AD Eddie Nunez have to say about the change. This is part of KUNM's Let's Talk New Mexico. Host Khalil Aculona first heard from Nunez.
It's like anybody else. If any regular student's allowed to obtain a scholarship, if it's an academic scholarship, a talent-based scholarship, music, anything else, and they work on the side or they're able to make money off their talent, music, cooking, whatever it is, why shouldn't they have the benefit of all opportunities? So as I sit here today, I think it would be wrong for just to say that just because they can make now money, that they should not have the ability to have a scholarship. Now, there might be opportunities in the future, depending on where things go, that maybe may lead to some kind of non-amateur kind of football approach or other sports, but we're talking really about a very small percentage of student athletes. And to say that we're going to do this across the board just for one or two because they generate some revenue, I don't think right now we're in the place to say that that's the right approach. But it's something that, as a whole, we have to be cognizant, and they have to also be responsible for their own business ventures and taxes and everything else that come along with what they generate.
And thank you for that. Mario, what's your reaction to that question?
Yeah, I agree with Eddie. I mean, I certainly don't think that you would penalize a student athlete who happens to be making, a pretty penny, I guess, to say, on NIL, so I agree with him 100%. I think as this is still in its infancy, I certainly hope, and I've been a proponent, that student athletes make money. There's a lot of other issues surrounding this topic, like, guardrails. I mean, you see some of these seven-figure deals, even though they're rare, but how is that going to impact recruiting and is it going to make, mid-major schools that much more tougher to recruit student athletes? But at the end of the day, I'm for the student athletes making money, whether they're on scholarship or not. But as this airplane is just taxiing down the runway on NIL, I think it's a long ways from student athletes, at least at New Mexico State, making significant dollars. We'll see what the future holds.
All right, we have a question from a listener. We've got Martinez from Albuquerque on the line. Martinez, welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico.
Hi, good morning. I have a quick question, and the question is what are the implications of this policy for international athletes, especially those who are on the UNM cross-country team who are largely coming from the UK? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Real quick for you, are you asking, what are the implications of the name, image, and likeness policy on students who are not American citizens?
Well, I would just like to know, are they also going to benefit from this type of policy in terms of commodification of their status? And if so, what does that stand for? If, for example, we have runners that come from the UK and they decide to do some kind of a campaign in London, for example, featuring the runners who run for UNM.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have got two athletic directors on the line. Do you all
Do either of you understand or know the specifics to that particular situation?
Well, I think it's the one area where she touched on, which is the international. There's still a lot of questions that linger over the international student athletes, and that is a concern of ours. We are working with our international office on campus to make sure that we do our due diligence, put everything in place, but give them the same opportunities. Very, very much like Mario mentioned earlier, we want every student athlete to have the opportunity to benefit here, regardless if they're from the United States or they're international. We have a good contingency, so does Mario, of international students that represent our institution unbelievably. I mean, we've had a couple that have garnered some opportunities in the Olympics, and which is we're very proud of. So to give them that chance to generate revenue either here or anywhere else, as long as they take care of they pay their taxes, do everything that needs to be done wherever they're from, how it's done, then we need to. But the Pell Grant, the portion of everything associated with an international or even our regular student athletes, right now, that's part of the dilemma that we're facing as ADs, is trying to have a clear pathway to allow everybody to follow kind of the same parameters. There's still a lot of different states doing different things, and so it's putting us in a really difficult situation. But I'll throw it to Mario, see if he has anything.
Mario.
Yeah, I would just echo what Eddie said. You know, I just have read actually an article that came out that, you know, international student athletes need to be very careful of accepting NIL deals because the way their scholarship is with coming into the United States, it could jeopardize that. So I am certainly for our international student athletes having the same opportunities. You know, what's interesting in New Mexico State, 80% of our student athletes come from five areas: Texas, New Mexico, California, Arizona, and our international group. You know, we've got from Arizona, California, and internationals about 50 to 55 student athletes each year. So we will certainly work with our partners on campus who really, you know, they know the latest rules regarding compensation and how that affects an international's student-athlete scholarship, because the last thing in the world, that's another piece to NIL. We certainly want to be doling out the proper advice so you don't put the international student-athlete in a bind. Just like Eddie, you've got great people on campus, and we will certainly, you know, maximize their opportunities, but do it in a way that won't jeopardize their eligibility.
Now, NMSU has embarked in really unconventional revenue streams, like having your own brand of tequila, to a pretty good amount of success. Yet, NMSU is an established school with a legal team to represent them. And this question is for you, Mario, but also you, Eddie. If a player decides to take on a scholarship for, say, like alcohol or recreational marijuana, how would that affect the school's commitment to a safe, responsible atmosphere for its students? Is that a policy that you, as individual institutions, UNM and NMSU, would basically say that players could not take part in?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that the NCAA, obviously, when NIL was allowed, they are not necessarily put in, hey, you can't, you know, participate in these categories. But the state law that was passed does have some guardrails on, you know, quote-unquote, sin categories. You know, personally, we have decided to dabble in the licensing of products, you know, beer, wine, and whiskey. So if a student athlete is over 21, that certainly wouldn't, you know, I would not be against it, but at the same time, there are some caveats in our personal New Mexico state law that I believe would prohibit that.
Okay, and we've got about a minute left. Before I ask you all the ultimate question, I just want to ask, how are things going as far as vaccination efforts with coaching staffs and players? Eddie, are the New Mexico football Lobos, are you all efficiently vaccinated so we can get a season going without any interruptions?
We are, first of all, our whole staff, all our coaches have been fully vaccinated. The majority of our staff, maybe one or two that are in the process of finalizing their vaccination, but anybody who has any interaction with our student athletes will have to be fully vaccinated. That's a decision we have made. And then as far as our student athletes, we're doing quite well when it comes to most of our teams. I mean, just as an example, our boys basketball team is 100%. Football is close to, if not over, they're probably closer to 75% right now. But we're working with probably a handful or more student athletes that are in the process of getting their vaccination. So, you know, at this point, with the mandate from the university to be fully vaccinated, that's going to probably encourage some others to fall in this. But we are going to work with them. This is not something we told that we said they have to do. If they choose not to, if for whatever reason, medical or religious based or anything, then we will work with them and they'll have to follow the same protocol and guidelines they did last year.
All right. I want to thank you both for being on the line with me. I've got Mario Mocha, the athletic director at New Mexico State University, and Eddie Nunez, the athletic director at the University of New Mexico. Before I let you both go, who is going to win the Rio Grande rivalry, the annual football game between UNM and NMSU next month?
I'm going to support our team, and we're going to go out there and do what we do best. But that's, I'll leave it at that.
And thanks to KUNM's Let's Talk New Mexico for that segment. We leave you this week with some information on research we've been following for some time. It shows that young people in the adult criminal justice system are 34% more likely to be arrested again than those convicted of similar offenses in juvenile court. Here's Roz Brown from the Texas News Service.
Texas is one of only three states that automatically treats 17-year-olds as adults when they're arrested. And the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition says that can often lead to a lifetime of involvement with the justice system. Since 2007, advocates to raise the age have encouraged state policymakers to change laws so teens can go through the juvenile justice system instead. Alicia Castillo with the coalition says in Texas, most 17-year-olds don't get rehabilitation services when they go into the adult system because treatment can only be accessed by those 18 and older.
So we just have this huge gap. If you're a 17-year-old and you are caught committing a crime, it's just a black hole of a lack of resources. But also, they're stuck with this adult record that follows them wherever they go.
A new report from the Sentencing Project looked at 11 states that have raised the age of criminal responsibility to 18. It found the change contributed to diverting more than 100,000 young adults into the juvenile system. Many Texas lawmakers have argued that raising the age would require building more detention facilities, but report author Marcy Mistra with the Sentencing Project, a research and advocacy center, says that theory largely has been proven false.
States that raised the age overall did not need to build new facilities, and even those that initially built extra were able to close them down after a couple of years.
Georgia and Wisconsin are the only other states that still automatically prosecute 17-year-olds as adults. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay up to date anytime with the latest news, weather conditions, traffic conditions, everything at KRWG.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.